Okay, today I am in Barry Island with Andrew Lowry. Thanks very much for agreeing to talk to us today, Andrew.
That's a pleasure.
For those that don't know, what is it you do?
Well, I run an advisory service, Optimum Racing, and I've run an advisory service, a racing advisory service now for over 20 years. Specialise in steeplechases, which do all year round. And then in the summer, when it's a little bit quieter with the jumpers, I also get involved with the flat race in the major meetings, Royal Ascots, Glorious Goodwoods, etc.
Okay, now I'm reliably informed that you're a rare beast that does actually provide a profitable service and has done for a long time. First of all, before we go into all the nitty-gritty of that, can you give us a little bit about your background in racing?
Yeah, well, I think it's in the blood. You know, my granddad and my father both loved a recreational bet. And I got interested in it from a very early age. You know, I can remember going to Chepstow and seeing all those great champion hurdlers compete in the Welsh champion hurdle, you know, like Knight Nurse, Monksfield, Sea Pigeon, horses like that. And that really captivated me. And, you know, going on from there, watching the racing on a Saturday with my father, having the odd bet then. And it was something that just always really appealed to me.
You were telling me earlier about your you mentioned your granddad there. You were telling me earlier about the an incident at the Derby.
Yeah, that's right. I think it was the first Derby after the war, and a horse called Airborne won it. It was obviously a popular choice on the day, and he was on the downs watching the race, and the bookmaker who took his bets did a runner, but a groover managed to actually find him, haul him down, and got his hod off him, and they all sat round and tried to equally divide it. I don't think they got anywhere near what they were all entitled to, but they divided it the best they could between them and made the best of a bad job.
Luckily that doesn't happen at racecourses anymore, but
exactly.
Excellent story. Okay, so you left school in 1985.
I did, yeah.
And you were, so there's a bit of a black hole between you leaving school and actually getting involved professionally in, well, racing for the first time. So what were you doing then?
Yeah, well, I left school probably as an underachiever, and as leaving school, I really had no idea what I wanted to do. You know, being involved in racing seemed a million miles away at the time. I'd always had an ambition to run my own company, but again, I didn't know where I was going to start with that. So I went, got myself a job in sales locally, and spent the next 10 years or so, you know, in that environment.
Okay, so were you betting then?
Oh yeah, very much so. You know, every spare hour I had was still very much involved with horse racing, only as a on a part-time basis. But I can remember some of the sales jobs I had, you know, allow you a bit of flexible time, if you like. And one particular job, I had an area that covered Herefordshire as well, and I used to spend all morning on calls. Would work my way through Wales into Hereford and do a few calls in the town, and then spend the afternoon at the racecourse. And so it was evident from a long way before I started that's why I was, say, destined to do, but certainly what I wanted to do. And one particular day when I went to Hereford races, I took the phone in with me, the mobile phone, and a client rang me, and he's placing an order with me, and it's all going swimmingly. I said, yes, we'll get those down to you in the next 48 hours. And before we could finish the conversation, the Hereford tannoy went off, and welcomed him and everyone to the race course. So we continued the conversation, and then at the end of it, he said, oh, one more thing, Andrew. I said, what's that? He said, make sure you win this afternoon, sir.
So were you successful betting at that point?
Overall, no. I found a niche in point-to-point racing. I used to go a lot of point-to-point racing every weekend, when Sunday racing came in, twice a weekend. And I was finding that I was making it pay, but it's a limited season, and whilst I was making money through the winter months with that, I was probably giving the lion's share of it back throughout the summer. And that's something I wanted to rectify. And I did that by joining an advisory service myself.
Ah, no, so we're getting to this is where I've got to know you from, is Mark Holder, who we interviewed recently. So you joined his tipping service in 96.
Yes, it would have been, yeah. I was working in Cardiff at the time, and I remember going to a local bookmaker's lunchtime and seeing the adverts on the wall. I was never much taken in by, you know, all the jargon. This will win hard hell. This can't get beat. This is the biggest certainty since David met Goliath and all that rubbish. I wanted something with a bit more substance to it. I knew a little bit about Mark's history in racing with his family. His father was a successful trainer. And thought, yeah, I'll give that a go.
Okay, because I used to like sending off for Ryan Hartley's One Horse Saturday Letter for £2 and R.S. Faulkner and all these, but they turned out to be, you know, this rip-off. So what do you think? You were lucky that you've won the mark, first of all, or did you have sort of faith in him?
Well, I was undoubtedly lucky that, you know, I went to the betting shop that one day where he had an advert in the paper. So, yeah, look, it could have been a number of services I joined at the time. But I knew what type of service I wanted, say, rather than just the brash sort of this'll win type approach. I wanted something with a bit more meat on the bones.
Okay, so I know Mark used to give reasons why they were backing horses. Was that part of your education as a winner finder, that being a part of the tipping service rather than just blindly following everything?
Yeah, well, I think that's what I was looking for, and it gives you more confidence if you know why someone's backing it or recommending you to back it. You know, why would you have your hard-earned cash on someone that just tells you a name of a horse? You know, you want to know why you want to be playing at that price. And I knew that's how Mark's service operated, you know, whether that was from the advert or one brief call. So that was, you know, that was the sort of service I wanted to join. And as well as making money from his service, I learned an awful lot listening to him, you know, with giving the reasonings for having a bet. And that's something that, you know, I still take with me to today, you know, and something that, you know, certainly stood me in, stood me in good stead at the time.
Okay, so when you started, was it you started winning almost straight away? You didn't have to go for a few losers and never take a leap of faith?
Well, no, I was very lucky again. I think with Mark, I know the first bet won. And I think three of his first four bets won. And soon after I joined, he took on board Alan Potts, another very successful punter, who himself specialised on, as far as the jump racing was concerned, when he was with Mark, he specialised in those chases. And he joined, it was probably 2 or 3 months after I'd subscribed to Mark, and his first five bets, he had one bet 5 consecutive days, up to 10-1, the first 5 all won. And I thought, blimey, you know, I've made the right choice joining this service. And so it wasn't so much a leap of faith. It didn't take me long to realise that these guys knew what they were talking about.
And was there any sort of staking advice? Because you can imagine a lot of people, especially inexperienced people, I know I would have done it, would have thought they found the golden goose and immediately overstretched and done their cobblers when they had a few losers.
Yeah, advice. I think at that time, Mark advised a monetary staking plan. I think, you know, he'd advise have £60 to win or whatever, and I stuck to that. You know, I wasn't in it to try and make a quick buck. I was thinking, you know, I want this to last. So, yeah, I think I gradually upped my stakes, but nothing dramatic. And sort of, you know, if Alan recommended a point system and I was playing to £50 a point, I would up that gradually to whatever level.
Okay, so how difficult was it in those days to get your bets on if you were winning?
I don't think it was difficult at all from memory. You know, I used to say I was still working full-time at that stage. So most of the time it would be cash going into betting shops. It's certainly no issue compared to how it is for most people nowadays.
Okay, and were you still betting the points at that point as well?
Yes, yeah, still enjoying the point-to-points. And like I say, I joined Mark at the end of the point, pretty much towards the end of the point season in May. But then as soon as it started again, yeah, the point-to-point is 100 chases, and yeah, very much doing my own thing as far as they were concerned.
Right, so it's quite surprising that so he's joined Mark Holder as a customer of his tipping service in 96, and then in 97... if I got my facts right, you actually went pro punting.
Yeah, it would have been end of 97, 98, around that sort
so
of time.
Was
yeah,
it on the
yeah.
back of you literally going pro punting on their advices? Or?
Not solely. I was starting to do a little bit more of my own, you know, learning from them as I was going along. But that was the inspiration, and I was quite happy to follow their advice, back my own judgment with the hunter chasers and pointer pointers. And I was doing, dabbling a little bit myself then, and learning as I went on.
Okay, you actually started working with Mark. When did you first meet him personally?
I first met him, I think it was the summer of about 98, would have been, Bath Racecourse. And I just approached him at the paddock, he was paddock watching. I introduced myself as a client and just told him how badly I wanted to get into racing. And if there was anything he could help me with, you know, however trivial he may have thought it was, then I would be more than willing to give it a go. Whether it was just sticking stamps on envelopes, I wanted at that stage desperately to get into racing, and into the betting side of it, but didn't really know still how to go about that.
So what happened next?
I'd taken the leap of faith to sort of jack my job in and go punting. And then on the back of some help from Mark and advice, I set up my own service. It was about 99. A subscription service came a few years later, but at that time I set up my own service on a premium rate line, 50p a minute or whatever it was in those days. And it just grew from there, really.
Okay, so now fast forward to now, you're run an advisory service. So what is your angle and edge?
Two edges, really. One, I put an awful lot of time and effort into what I do. Secondly, as well as hard work, you have to have a method as well as putting all the hours in. And sectional timings are very much part of my success and has been for over 15, 16 years now.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your sectional timings? That seems to be a bit of a theme recently with people I've been speaking to. How did you get involved with that?
I say it's about 15, 16 years ago now, and Mark Holder was using them successfully for hurdle racing, and he rang me up and he said, look, I got something that's going to completely change your punting. He said, I want you to try these sectional timing methods. He'd obviously, say, done them on hurdles. He wasn't sure, I don't think, at the time, whether they'd work over fences. But if anything, I think they're probably better or more reliable over fences. Horses tend to go more of an even gallop because of the nature of the jumping. And there's more obstacles per every mile over fences than hurdles. So I started, I remember there was one particular race at Exeter, and there was a horse called Backbeat. It got beaten about 20, 25 lengths. My horse called Ashley House, who was pretty useful. It was turned out again 2 or 3 weeks later. And I remember speaking to Mark and saying, look, I got this horse. I said, but it looks to be very, very well handicapped on what he did at Exeter last time. I said, the only problem, though, is that it was beaten 20, 25 lengths. Will that stack up? He said, oh, don't worry about that. If the figures say he's performed to that level, and sure as eggs, it went and won, and that was a eureka moment, very much so.
So how many hours work does go into each day's betting then?
It depends on how many meetings a day, but if on one particular meeting, for example, you'd probably spend 2-3 hours analysing that, because I only concentrate on the steeplechases, so on an average card we perhaps have 3 chases, so that'd take me a couple of hours. And then an hour or so to analyse the figures at the end of the day. So if you've got a busy Saturday, that can add up.
Okay, so what did you make the decision just to concentrate on the chases to begin with?
I think it was because I had a very much a like for point-to-pointing and hunter chases from an early stage, and it developed into there. And also my own punting when I was starting off, tended to have a lot more success with the chasers and the hurdlers for whatever reason, so it just seemed a natural progression. And I was always very keen not to overstretch. I think it's important to specialise in one thing or another. And I think the chasers probably interest me a bit more as well.
Okay, so how would you get up in the morning, how do you approach each day's race, and what is your modus operandi?
Well, I'd start by looking at the more competitive chase races on the day. You know, so if we got three meetings, there might be three or four 10 runner or more handicap chases. So they would be, you know, that would be my my starting point, and look at those, go through, analyze each horse using my own ratings, which I derive from sectional timings, and having then just gone through the form using all the other vital criteria, you know, trainer form, go in, trip, track, and all the rest of it, will then sort of do my own tissue. And then if I feel there's a mistake made, i.e. there's this horse a lot bigger price available than the price I perceive its chance to be, then I'll advise it to clients as a bet.
Okay, what about form books and stuff? What sort of tool, do you use any specific tools or ratings yourself?
I don't use any other ratings, but I use Raceform Interactive for all the form. I find that very, very good, very easy to use. In the old days, it was all manual, but I've been using that now for probably at least the last sort of 10, 12 years.
Okay, so do you used to sort of, obviously, you're still mates with Mark Oden and people. Do you collaborate with other pro punters to come up with your selections?
No, not at all, no. Mark, as you know, specialises in hurdlers, and I specialise in the chasers. So, but I'll still speak to him, and you know, we take his advice here and there, but no, we wouldn't collaborate for any actual bets.
And have you got anybody that occasionally rings up a mole in a yard that would say, this one today, would you take any heed of anything like that from anyone?
No. If someone comes up in one year out the other, you know, you learn the hard way that a lot of inside information is absolute rubbish.
You've crunched all the figures, you've done your form, is there like a criteria for a bet? Do you see something, you think, right, that's a bet, have you got a formula for that sort of thing?
It's an analytical formula, really. You know, once I've priced up every horse in the race to the best of my ability, it's all down to figures then. And for me to send it out, I'm quite a selective with the bets I give clients. A lot of my clients have been with me since I worked with Mark Holder back in 2004. Two or three even before that, and they're not £10 punters. You know, these guys look at it as a long-term investment. They're having serious money on, so I can't be asking them, you know, even if I could find the bets, it'd be difficult to ask them to go and have four or five bets a day. They're looking for guaranteed value, horses that are, you know, substantially overpriced, and on average I find, you know, maybe a couple of those a week, but as well as that, for those who want more action, I will also, on a, you know, daily preview line, highlight other sort of positives and negatives on the cards for people who want to have more than maybe a couple of bets a week.
Isn't that a bit counterproductive? Sometimes you think, oh, well, you get two or three of those wins and your nap doesn't you?
Yeah,
it can
do, absolutely. But I think if you look at it analytically and just from the maths point of view, it takes the emotion out of it. So, you know, if you say, right, horse A, I'm happy to back at 5-1. You know, for small stakes, 6.5, 7-1. I'm happy to, you know, there's enough of an edge then to send it out to the clients. And I think if you stick with that criteria, you're not going to go too far wrong, providing your methods are correct in the first place.
Right, one of the things that interests me from what you talked about, you say you price up a race, and then you, depending on the value that you can see there, you sort of act on it and offer your client. That's quite a skill to have, to be able to price up a race accurately and to actually do it better than the bookmakers that you're sort of competing against. So where did you learn that skill?
Well, it's just something that, you know, I've learned to improve as time goes on, really. But it's something I've started off with a long time ago. And I think as long as you've got confidence in the work you're putting in and, you know, the belief that your prices are right, then, you know, it's a big, it's an important tool to have in your armoury.
Okay, so where do you start pricing up a race? Do you start with the favourite, or do you, you know, how?
No,
what makes you think something is a 2-1 chance?
Right, well, okay, well, first thing I would do is to try and rule out a couple of the horses. If you've got a 12-runner race, you know, it might not take too long to rule three or four out, and you're happy to price them up at 100-1 or 50-1 or whatever. I'll then try and put them in some sort of order, who I think has got the best chance down to who's got the least chance of winning. And it just becomes a knack of knowing how much better you think horse A is over horse B. And then the figures just sort of follow on from that, really. It's just something that comes with practice.
Okay, so when you've sorted out your bets for your clients, do you back them yourself as well?
Yes, I do. I back all the account bets that I send out, as I say, on average a couple a week, and I'd back quite a few of the horses that I put up as preferences as well, depending on what price they are, later on in the afternoon.
Okay, so how serious a punter are you? You'd have to tell us how much, stake-wise.
Not as big now as I was when I started out. I think, when you start out, you've got no responsibilities. I could cope with the big highs and the big lows in those days. But when you bring up a young family, I've got three boys, there's enough pressure making the advisory service successful without the added pressure of betting very heavily. Because we all know, you're going to have losing runs as well as the winning runs. And whilst, I remember back in 2002, I had a particularly good year punting. I also know there were one or two very bad months, during that year. So I found it more and more difficult to cope with that, as I went on with having the responsibility of bringing up a young family.
Okay, is the fact that a large group of people, your customers, are all trying to get on the same horse at the same time a bit counterproductive? Do you see a collapse in the price, or does it not affect the market that badly?
It used to, years ago, it used to have a dramatic effect. Now, not so much so. If you phone in sort of an hour after the message goes out, you expect to take a point below the advised price. But generally nowadays, it tends to hold up pretty well.
Okay, so what percentage of your income is winning bets, and what percentage would be subscriptions?
Well, the lion's share very much with subscriptions. As I say, I found it more and more difficult to put as much emphasis on my punting. And I made a conscious decision at that time that I wanted to be successful when I set out with my advisory service. I didn't want it to be, a 5-minute wonder. I wanted longevity. And I think the only way you're going to achieve that is, by giving that your absolute 100% concentration. There's been many, many a good punter, even plenty of bookmakers who've tried to succeed with running an advisory service and haven't. It's not easy, and I think you can perhaps do one or the other. I think it's very difficult to do both. And for now, I'm more than happy to sort of push Optimum Racing forward, keep growing the business and building that. Who knows, down the line, I might well want to go back punting and make that my main sort of source of income. It's not something I'd rule out, but at the moment I'm happy the way things are.
Now, the pressure on a punter to win that's got a job is quite high. The pressure on a punter that's doing it for a living is extremely high. I imagine the pressure on it, if you're tipping them to other people, is even higher, and then you've got three kids and a wife. So how do you cope with that pressure?
Well, that's a good question. Again, I think you learn to grow thick skin as far as that's concerned. But you have to have 100% confidence in your own ability. I know how hard I work at what I do. I'm not saying we're the most successful service out there, but there wouldn't be many that work harder than I do at it. And if I put the hours in and show the commitment that I do, then win, lose or draw, at the end of the day, I can sleep well.
Okay, so what would be, talking about sleeping well, what would be the worst losing run that you've suffered as a paid tipster, client tips that you've given out?
Blimey. I've been going 20-odd years now, mind Simon, so there's been, probably been a few. But the way I bet, as I say, we are selective, looking at a couple of bets a week. We play with the odds very much in our favour, do a fair bit of each way betting. There hasn't been many disasters, if any. I've gone double figures without a winner on one or two occasions, but nothing dramatic, touch wood.
Okay, you've never been on the verge of turning it all in, thinking I've gone at the game?
No. There's been a fair few lows. There's times you think, oh, why am I doing this? But even when it's not going right, I love the sport so much, and I feel very privileged that I've turned a hobby and a lifelong passion into a living. That even when things aren't going well, there's nothing else I'd rather be doing. I certainly wouldn't want to be back in one of my sales jobs.
The trouble is with a lot of punters, especially probably ones that are a bit new to the game, they see you charge an X amount of money for tips, and they expect them all to win.
Mm.
Now, have you had abuse from punters, and have you had any that you said, look, mate, you might as well just turn this in yourself because you haven't got the temperament for it? Is any much of that?
Yeah, over the years, there's been a fair bit of that. Thankfully, things have calmed down a lot lately. I think I've got an understanding clientele base now who realise it is all about the long term, it's not about the short term. You're going to have a couple of losing weeks, but it's irrelevant if the next 3 or 4 weeks make decent profits. And so over the years we've attracted the odd, I don't know what the right word is, but people's expectations are sometimes just far too high. And like you say, they pay good money, they expect every tip to win. It's not never going to be like that. But you just have to to take them with a pinch of salt, really. They're always going to be about, but thankfully things seem to have calmed down lately.
And do you take time to advise customers on staking? Because probably the most important thing of all is staking, really.
Yeah, I use a staking plan. And I'm always more than happy to speak on the phone to people who often get asked how they should stake things, and more than happy to give my advice on that. And I think we touched on it before, it's important to sort of gradually increase your stake. One of the worst things that can happen is they join me, we have a very good month, they might win 20, 30 points in a month, and all of a sudden they think they found the golden goose that lays the golden egg, and multiply their stake in by 5 or 10, and then the inevitable losing run follows somewhere down the line and you don't hear from them again.
Okay, Andrew, now you've been in the game 2 decades now, so you've obviously done well because you wouldn't have any customers left. A lot of people that I've spoken to that are successful backing horses mainly have said that nothing stays the same. They've always got to keep evolving. What worked 2 or 3 years ago probably doesn't work now, and you have to keep finding an extra edge. Have you found that similar scenario with what you've been doing?
Yeah, very much so. What was a huge edge with sectional timings, for example, 15 years ago, that's not the obvious edges from that perspective aren't there anymore. But they're still there if you're prepared to dig in a bit deeper, put that extra work into it. There's an instance on New Year's Day, for example, a horse of Harry Fry's ran called, I think it was Captain Drake. And he'd run on the same card at Exeter previously to a horse he was competing with on New Year's Day. And they were a similar sort of price New Year's Day in the morning. But when you looked at the sectionals, Captain Drake, who he'd unseated his rider 2 out, he'd sprawled on landing that day, and the other horse had run in a separate race on the same card. And if you look at their performance to 2 out, Captain Drake was about 15, 20 lengths better. And yet, morning of this race, they wanted to make him the same sort of price. Now, they don't all work out like that, but that's an example as where perhaps not looking for the obvious, as it was 15 years ago, that there's still very much the odd diamond to be found.
Talking of diamonds to be found, you've also had a bit of sports betting, dabbled in sports betting, or did. Now, you backed Paul Hunter at 66-1 to win the Welsh Snooker Open.
I did.
Are you Paul Hunter's mate, or how did you come up with that?
The much missed Paul Hunter. Yeah, no, that's when I first started betting seriously, if you like. And I used to watch and bet on a lot of snooker at the time, and I'd followed his progress. And just, the Welsh Open was very local. I used to go and watch a lot of that in Newport at the time. He was just massively overpriced. And I remember I had tickets for the final session of the final, and we'd been point-to-point in somewhere over in Lark Hill, I think it was, and got back into Newport, and I think he was 5-3 up, and watched the whole thing and evolve around me then, and he ended up winning 9-6, 9-7. So yeah, that was a nice win. It gave me a big confidence boost as well, a financial boost at the time as well, to kick on and carry on doing what I was doing.
Okay, so is sports betting a part of your portfolio these days?
On my own betting, personally, no, very, very little. But we do run a sports service through Optimum. I've got a very good judge who runs that for me, specialises in cricket, football, the odd other sport as well. So I leave that all to him. He's much more equipped to make a profit on that than I am.
Okay, we're going to go into your ownership stuff in a minute. But what would you say, what's it, the worst part about your chosen profession as a paid tipster?
Yeah, I guess the worst part is losing runs, because whilst I'm, you know, thick-skinned enough now, and you know, I know it's part and parcel of the game. It's going to happen when you're taking on clients. Certainly, when you're taking on new clients, and maybe the first two or three get beat, that brings added pressure. And I think the pressure brought along by a losing run is still probably the worst part of it.
Okay, now you've apart from the Optimum Tipping advisory service, you've also got Optimum Ownership, which you've had some success with.
Yeah, we've had huge success over the years with that. I owned horses myself going back from 2001, I guess, and we had success with the very first horse we bought, a horse called Dat My Horse, who won 3 over hurdles for us, gave us a day out at Royal Ascot. And you know, as I say, has a good initial success with that. So when I went on my own, I worked with Mark Holder between 2004-2006, and then went back on my own with Optimum Racing on the back of that. And one of the things I wanted to do was to run a syndicate. And the very first one we bought there, a horse called City Affair, and he won his first 3. And we then had Little Shilling, who was a remarkable horse, paid about less than $5,000 for him, 4.8 I think it was. And he managed to win 6 races in just over a month. It's quite incredible. So yeah, we've had many other multiple winners throughout the syndicate as well. So it's a lot of fun.
So when did you decide to sort of run the syndicates? I mean, and who picks the horses?
I tend to pick them from a form perspective, but whenever I've bought one, I've always taken someone with me who knows about, you know, the horse itself, because I wouldn't know if that horse was lame as a cat or not, you know. And so I will do a lot of groundwork first, from the form, but make sure I got an expert judge with me.
Okay, were you surprised about the realities of owning a racehorse? It sounds like you've been quite lucky. I mean, I think a lot of people imagine that if you own a racehorse, you know exactly when it's going to win, exactly when it's not going to win, and all that sort of thing. I mean, what are the actual realities, apart from the extremely expensive nature of that?
Yeah, we've had a lot of luck. We've had a lot of bad luck with injuries and, you know, fatalities along the way as well. It hasn't all been a bed of roses. But no, nothing overly surprised me. I went in with my eyes open. I was warned it wasn't going to be cheap. And, you know, even though we had a lot of success early on, that's why I was keen then to run it as a syndicate, to split the cost, because it is a very expensive hobby to get into.
So did you run the syndicate as a business concern? Is it to sort of try and make a bit of money, or is it to just cover your expenses, or how does it work?
Yeah, I run it on a non-profit basis, and it's there really to hopefully boost the company's image. You know, when we had the likes of Little Shilling running at Cheltenham Festival and winning 6 races on the bounce, that was very much, it's all plus for as far as the company's concerned. So, and it's really exclusive for members of Optimum Racing. So it's just part of the business, but it's a non-profit part of the business.
Okay, owning a horse or horses proved profitable as punting goes, knowing exactly when they're fit, you know, you don't have to, the guesswork is taken out of your own one. So have you profited back in your own horses?
Yeah, we've got it right more often than we got it wrong. But again, they don't all win. But over the years, yeah, we've had some good touches. Little Shilling was one of the first, as I say, with the syndicate. And I remember, say we paid 4.8, I think it was, for him, just to buy a horse to try and win a seller. Tim Vaughan trained it for me, and I'd found this one race, and the horse wasn't quite right. And then we found a seller at Fakenham, And I remember ringing up Tim just before the sort of declaration stage. And I said, is everything okay? He said, well, I'm not sure. Oh, what's wrong now? He said, well, this horse is too good for a seller, Andrew. I said, don't worry about that. You just get him there 100% fit and we'll worry about the rest. And that was the first of his six wins. And thankfully, there was no bid for him at all on the day either. So it was a very, very good day.
That must be quite nice when a trainer tells you that. Why Tim Vaughan?
Why Tim Vaughan? Good question. Well, it came by chance how I met Tim, first of all. It was in the days where I had a couple of pointer pointers, and Christian Williams' dad, Rob Williams, trained them for me in Ogmore, where Christian's based now. And Christian was due to run a mare of mine, I think it was Dolby Carr, we had running down at Kilwendeg in West Wales. So we turned up, and just sort of half an hour before the race, I go out to the notice board to see what we're up against. And as I'm writing down the runners, out comes this tall lad in my silks. And I thought, well, that's not Christian. And it turned out it was Tim. Now, Christian, he was due to ride. Obviously, his dad trained the horse. And Rob said to me then, he said, oh, no, Christian's been... he's misbehaved a bit last few days. He said, so I stopped him from riding any of my horses. I thought, great, thanks, Rob. And so that's how I met Tim. And as the race turned out, he actually, little Christian was barred from riding his dad's horses for the day. He was on the second favourite against us, but we managed to beat him by about two lengths. And that was how I met Tim. And at the time, or maybe just shortly after that, he had one horse he trained himself for pointer points, a horse called Robo Astar, who the last time I saw it was trained by Pat Murphy, and Pat was at the start at Worcester with a long tom trying to get the damn thing to move. I thought, well, if Tim can win a pointer point with this, which he did, I think he might be the one to send one to, and that's how it all started. And I was the first person ever to send Tim a horse.
Because how many, do you know if you had, how many winners you've had?
For the syndicate, I think we've had 28, and I had a fair few more of that before the syndicate went in my own name. Yeah.
Okay, so how far would you like your ownership to go?
It's something at the moment we've only got the one horse, but I am looking to get another one next month or so. And I see it as something I'd like to develop again in the future. Yeah, but I think you've got to wait. You've got to get the right horse. There's no point just going out and buying one for the sake of it. But yeah, if we can drum up enough interest, it's part of the business I would like to grow, because it's so much fun, and it's a cheap way for people to get involved.
Okay, so finally, what does the future hold for you? Where would you like to see yourself in 10 years' time?
As long as I'm still here in 10 years' time, that would be a start, but... No, I think certainly for the next 4 or 5 years, my emphasis is on Optimum Racing. I'd love to keep pushing that forward. After that, who knows, maybe I'll still be kicking around doing the same thing, or maybe I would have gone more the punting route off my own back again. But one way or other, I think I'll certainly still be in racing, hopefully.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. We look forward to seeing that all pans out, and thanks very much for the interview.
Pleasure. Thank you.
StarSports.bet provide the complete betting experience. Find us online via our website and app, on course, and at our flagship betting shop in London's Mayfair. 18 years and older only. BeGamblerAware.org.